Today on Future Tense, the developer who believes future generations should be taught computer language by playing with wooden blocks, the vision-impaired man who had trouble buying a decent stovetop, and this guy.
I'm Tom Griffiths, Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-author of the book Algorithms to Live By. In our book, we explore the computational structure of problems that show up in the course of our everyday lives. Nobody has enough time or space in our cupboards, and while these seem like uniquely human problems, they're not. Computers also have to use their time efficiently and manage limited memory. And the algorithms that computer scientists have developed for solving these problems are equally applicable to human lives.
Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, an algorithm is just a simple sequence of steps that you use to solve a problem. So while we associate the word algorithm today with what computers do, the first algorithms were things that were done by people.
So time to swallow our human pride. Well, perhaps. Tom Griffiths is the co-author with Brian Christian of Algorithms to Live By, the computer science of human decisions.
So if you go back to the origins of the word, really it came from, you know, the sort of simple procedures that you'd use for solving a math problems. So in school, you learn some algorithms for doing things like addition and multiplication and subtraction and division and so on. And then those algorithms were things that human beings would use to solve math problems. And then when we had computers come along, computers instantiated those algorithms. So part of what we're doing in the book is actually going back to the origins of algorithms as, you know, solutions to problems that people can use, and then taking some of the insights that come from the methods of computer science and thinking about how to analyze what makes a good algorithm and applying those insights to the algorithms that we use in our human lives. So the kinds of problems that we look at in the book are things like, you know, knowing how long you should spend looking for a flat or looking for your spouse, trying to figure out how you should balance novelty and familiarity when you're deciding what restaurant you want to go to. Do you go to the place which is your favorite, or do you try a new place? Or knowing how to efficiently alphabetize your bookshelf, or perhaps making the decision about whether you should alphabetize that bookshelf, or organizing your cupboards, you know, figuring out where you should be putting things to be most efficient. These all turn out to be problems which are directly analogous to the problems that computers have to solve. And as a consequence, there are efficient solutions to them.
So how does algorithmic thinking, how does it actually help us solve those kinds of problems that you've just given there as examples?
So each of these problems maps onto a kind of mathematical theory. So for example, the problem of, you know, how many flats you should look at before you decide to make an offer, or perhaps, you know, how many people you should go on dates with before you decide which one you're going to commit to, maps onto a set of problems that are coming from a mathematical theory called the theory of optimal stopping. And one classic result in that literature says, if you've got a pool of possibilities or a fixed amount of time that you're going to be conducting your search over. So say you're going to be looking for flats for a month and you're trying to find the best possible flat during that period. Then the procedure that you should follow is to look at the first 37% of those. So, you know, spend 37% of your time looking at places before you're even ready to make an offer. And then at the point where you have seen 37%, you switch from looking to being ready to make an offer on the first place that you see that's better than the best of the places that you've seen so far. So that's a very simple procedure that you can follow, and it's the procedure that maximizes the probability that you end up finding the best possible place.
So is this all about mathematics, or are you suggesting that this algorithmic style of thinking could actually help us dealing with issues and problems that are not mathematical, or at least not apparently mathematical in their makeup?
Part of it is that there are these simple mathematical solutions to these problems. But the other part is a part that feels a lot more like kind of understanding the wisdom of computer science. So, you know, rather than being very specific, very precise mathematical prescriptions, which we can offer in some places, there's also a kind of broader insight that thinking about these problems in this way provides. So, for example, I talked about the problem of how you decide, you know, what restaurant you're going to go to, right? So, you know, when you do that, you face this tension between what's the way we talk about in the book is the tension between the new and the best. So trying something new versus trying the thing that you know is definitely a good thing. When you try something new, there's a chance that it's less good than the best experience that you already know, but you're getting more information, which in the future means that, you know, you're potentially going to be able to go to a better restaurant. It could turn out to be better than your favorite restaurant. It could be your new favorite. So in making that decision, there's a lot of trade-offs you have to make. And computer scientists talk about those decisions in terms of what they call the explore-exploit trade-off, the trade-off between kind of exploring new options and exploiting the knowledge that you've gathered so far. So there's a couple of interesting things that we can learn from the computer science of the explore-exploit trade-off. So one of them is that when you're solving this problem, what matters to the solution is how many choices you're going to be able to make in the future. Trying something new is more valuable if you're going to have more opportunities to exploit the knowledge that you've acquired. You know, if you're going to visit a town and you're going to be living in that town for a year, then you should be trying all sorts of new things because it's, you know, anything that you find out, you're going to be able to exploit over the rest of that year. But if you're going to go visit a town and you're only going to be staying there for a week, then maybe you want to try a couple places and then find one that seems really good and then, you know, sort of, you know, stick with that good possibility. And, you know, if you only have one more day left in town, then there's no point trying a new thing. You should just go to the best one that you found so far. So that insight is actually really interesting from the perspective of thinking about things like human aging. If we think about, you know, our lifespan as the period over which we're learning and having the opportunity to try new things and benefit from what we discover from them, the thing that it tells us is, to start out with, we should be very exploratory. And that's something which is very consistent with, you know, what happens with small children, basically trying to explore the whole world around them, you know, including putting things in their mouth that they shouldn't. And then at the other end of our lives, it tells us that what we should be doing as we're aging is switching more from exploration to exploitation, to enjoying the things that we've discovered to be the good things. And the kind of prediction that comes out of that, which is borne out by psychological research, is that, you know, as you get older, you're perhaps going to be narrowing down the set of things that you try and the set of people who you interact with, but you're also going to be drawing more value from those sort of favorite interactions that you formed over the course of your lifespan.
And is there a bit of a human barrier, though, to taking on this type of thinking? I mean, a lot of us like to think that we are rational when we're making decisions, even when we're not, or even when we're not necessarily thinking or planning in a systematic way. So is there a bit of a kind of a block to being told that there is a better way to think and that perhaps you should take it on?
Well, one of the interesting insights that we got as we looked into the literature about how computers solve all of these different kinds of problems is that in many ways, the solutions that computers actually use look more like kind of human solutions than like the intuitions that we have about what rational behavior might be. So I think that's something which is quite important because if what we're doing is saying maybe we should be taking these insights from computer science and using them in the context of our lives, you know, when you say that, the immediate response that you have is you kind of think about robots and, you know, Mr. Spock from Star Trek, and, you know, you kind of think about these examples that we have of people who seem like they're acting very logically and very rationally, but then getting themselves all tied up in knots because there's a failing of that kind of rational impulse to make contact with the world. And so what's interesting is that, you know, when you think about a computer as a system which considers all of the possibilities and grinds through those possibilities and then, you know, eventually comes to exactly the right solution, that's actually not a good characterization of the way that computers work when they try and solve the challenging sorts of problems that are the sorts of things that human beings face. So when computers face these hard problems, the things that are at the limits of what computers are able to do, then they do things like try and solve simpler versions of those problems and then use that to give you an approximate solution, or not necessarily consider all of the possibilities, just consider a subset of them and then make the best of that subset, or using chance as part of coming up with a solution and then following an algorithm which gives you a high probability of getting the right answer but might give you something that's a little bit wrong. And so all of those strategies are things that have analogs in, I think, the way that people face problems, where human reasoning is something which also has this trade-off between how much computational effort you put in and how much error you make. And so I think recognizing that both human beings and computers face that kind of trade-off gives us a more nuanced definition of what rational behavior might be like. And it's a definition of rational behavior that's much more consistent with the way that our real human minds work.
So stop thinking like a human and start thinking like an algorithm, which is actually like thinking like a human and not like a computer, at least not a human-conceived one, if you understand where I'm going. Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions, is the name of Tom's book, and it was co-authored with Brian Christian.
New ideas, new approaches, new technologies, the edge of change. This is Future Tense. Follow us on Twitter at RNFutureTense.
I found out that I was going to be a dad in 2013. And I've always worked in technology and design and in startups. So I've always known programming to be something extremely important that I wanted my son to learn from when he was very young. And it's something that I wanted him to learn alongside reading or arithmetic, because I think that programming is a new literacy. And I couldn't really find anything that combined the natural way in which a child plays at ages 3 to 6, but also introduces them the basis of programming logic.
So what UK-based entrepreneur Filippo Jacob did was he created a wooden toy set, a language-free, gender-neutral toy, which he called Cubetto.
It's a playset. So imagine a toy, because it has the accessibility of a toy. And there are three main elements to this playset. There is Cubetto, which is the wooden robot, and he moves in a 2D plane. And there is an interface board, which you can think of as a keyboard. And there are a set of instruction blocks that are used to control the robot. And these are colorful blocks that you can touch, that you can play with, and you can arrange them into a program, into a meaningful sequence that a child creates to move Cubetto from A to B. And you insert them inside the interface board following what is called the queue of instructions. And you create these sequences. And by doing so, a child is not only designing the first program, but when they press the go button on the interface board, they've seen their program being executed by Cubetto right in front of them. And the thing to focus on of this playset is, in fact, the tangible blocks. Because what we've done is we've taken something that is normally abstract and screen-based and turned it into something that is tangible and fits into the natural way in which a child plays and learns. So really what we try to do during the research, when we decide, okay, well, what does it mean to learn to program? We found two things that we wanted to combine. The first one was Montessori early learning hands-on principle. I think the best quote that I can think of to describe that is from Marie Montessori herself, when she said that the path to a child's mind is through their hands. And the second thing that we found was the Logo Turtle and Logo programming language, not to be confused with Lego, which was a procedural programming language that was invented in the 60s and 70s and then used also in the 80s by an educator, a lifelong educator and technologist called Seymour Papert, who was the founder of the MIT Media Labs. What he designed was a programming language and a system whereby you could draw something on a screen using a triangle and a program by inputting very simple procedures into the interface. So you could tell the triangle to go forward 20, left, right. And with this triangle, you would draw a little picture on a screen. And the whole idea is that you can teach a child every single programming concept out there while having them focus on creativity and creative output fundamentally.
So the interesting thing then about Cubetto then is that you're actually teaching very young children about programming language, but you're teaching them without the use of screens, aren't you? You're teaching children who aren't yet at the stage where they would want to or are allowed to use a screen.
That's the whole point, because it combines the two things. It combines Montessori hands-on play with Logo programming language, and it does remove the screen. Because one of the things that we realized is, first of all, we're not against the screen, but we realized that at that age, it's a distraction, and children normally associate screens with entertainment. We also found that children engage far more when they have the chance to play in a physical, dynamic, and social environment. So you're absolutely right. The whole idea was, how can we introduce programming without a screen? And that's how we did it.
So why is it important for children as young as 3 to learn about programming language?
So there are two reasons that I really advocate for them learning this early. The first thing is that, you know, Steve Jobs famously said, everybody should learn how to program a computer because it helps you learn how to think. And it's very true. Because programming or understanding computer programming, we're not talking about coding here, we're talking about computational thinking. Understanding computational thinking gives you a mindset and the ability to look at problems, break them down, and solve them. And that is a skill that is learned when you learn computational thinking, and that serves you well for the rest of your life. No matter what you do, even if you never touch a computer ever again, learning to program, which strangely actually has nothing to do with computers, is extremely useful to develop your mind. And the second thing is that we live in a world where by 2020, there are going to be 50 billion connected devices all around us. That is 50 billion computers that are embedded in almost every object that is in our life, from a chair to a microphone to a light to the streets. And I think it's important. We believe that it's important that a child, no matter what he wants to do in life, should grow up understanding how the world around them works. And it's important that they at least have the basic knowledge of how this technology works. And also probably there's a third reason why we believe that programming is very important in general, whether you learn it at 3 or at 6. And it's that in order to be creative, in order to express ourselves as humans through music, through art, through science, we do this with computers these days. They allow us to do those things better, faster, and more creatively. And so in many ways, learning how to harness machines for this creativity is actually what allows us to continue to affirm our own humanity as a species. But that's probably a more existential sort of point of view that we have. But I think it's a nice one.
So as you say, I mean, this is as much about helping very young children to structure their way of thinking, to think in a logical way, as much as it is about introducing them to the concept of computational thinking.
You know, at that age, outcomes on what you learn from 3 to 6 are hard to measure because you measure them much later in life. You know, when you're 20, when you're 22, when you're 23, it's a long road that you have to wait a long time before you can measure some kind of outcomes. But the important thing is that you give children the language. They do know that they are coding a robot. They do know that they're debugging by changing a block. So you're giving them the language and the environment in which they can learn within context. And when you think about actual programming, it's something that we do very naturally. When we learn to put on a sock before we put on a shoe, because if we do it the other way around, it's not so great, doesn't feel so good. That's programming. You're learning to sequence. And when they are playing with Cubetto, they are learning and seeing computational thinking right in front of them. They learn that a forward, left, and forward sequence is different than a left, forward, and left sequence. Or even more simply, they learn that a forward and then left sequence is different than left and forward. And that's quite important. And then this is what you need to learn in order to then go on to coding later on. Think of this as the ABC equivalent. If you don't know ABC, if you don't know your phonics, it's kind of difficult to go on and then eventually read and eventually start learning from reading. This is the exact same thing, but for programming.
Learning to program in early years should be fun, it should be playful, it should be like a game. Cubetto is a simple, hands-on system.
And as an educational toy, Cubetto is universal, isn't it, in the sense that it works regardless of a child's mother tongue?
Yes, and that was one of the absolute criteria that the toy needed to fit. It had to be culture neutral and gender neutral. And by removing all lettering from it and by removing all kinds of necessary reading, there is some material, but that's more for the parent. We've made something that is now sold in 86 countries, and it works exactly the same anywhere you are, no matter what language you speak, and it works incredibly well in a growing multicultural society, which we felt was really important that it was represented in this toy. And also, more importantly, I think it does, we really wanted to create something that was really gender neutral. So originally, the toy moved a car around, and we kind of wanted to replace this with a universal symbol, two universal symbols, which I think are also understood not only across countries, but also across genders. And the car became a cube and a smile.
Filippo Jakob, the co-founder and CEO of Primo Toys. And the game in question was Cubetto. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Here's a little experiment you can try. Take your smartphone out of your pocket, turn it on, and then close your eyes. Now try and phone a friend. An impossible task? Well, welcome to the world of the visually impaired. The 19th of May marked International Accessibility Awareness Day, and our final guest today has spent the past 26 years campaigning for more accessible technology for the blind. His name is David Woodbridge. He's visually impaired himself, and he's the Senior Adaptive Technology Consultant for Vision Australia. According to David, over those 26 years, there have been ups, downs, and ups again.
I remember when I first got my first mobile phone, it didn't speak at all. So it didn't speak out what was on the screen or the button. So I could just answer and hang up a phone call. I couldn't do SMS sending. But then we had some accessibility. So there was a talking program that actually made the phone talk. And of course, when we then started using, God forbid, touchscreen technologies, you sort of basically threw up your hands and went, oh my God, that's the end of accessibility. I'm never going to be able to use a mobile phone again. And luckily, all the major manufacturers now have built-in speech technology that makes the screen speak back to me no matter what I'm using. So, you know, as technology moves ahead, so does the change. And the change is getting a lot closer now between new tech coming out and then making it accessible.
But I imagine for somebody who is visually impaired, there are always going to be challenges as new forms of technology come on board.
That's right. So, for example, you know, when the smartphones and the tablets came out, we had to have a range of, you know, assistive software built into it or third-party applications to make it accessible. So, you know, back in the bad old days, the 90s and the early 2000s, we might have had to wait sometimes 12 to 18 months before things were made accessible via software or hardware changes. Now, basically, when new stuff comes out, it's not too bad. But mind you, you know, as far as, you know, desktop computers and smartphones and tablets go, they're all good. But when it starts getting a little bit messy is when people start to update stuff in your home, which then starts using touchscreen technology, which then, of course, makes it very hard for blind or low vision people to access.
And by that, we're talking about things, you know, like ovens, like fridges, which might have a touchscreen display, not the more modern ones. It's a very important point, isn't it, that we're not just talking about forms of communication technology, communication devices, but an awful lot of the products in our houses are going digital.
We're currently in the process of updating our kitchen. So I wandered over to a couple of different retail stores a couple of weeks ago, and all I wanted was a hot plate. Nice and straightforward. You put your pot on it, turn it on, and it heats up your water and so on. Do you think I could actually find a hot plate in the store that actually had knobs? No, they were all touchscreen based. And when I spoke to the person behind the actual counter, so to speak, I said, I can't use a touchscreen hot plate. I need one that's got knobs on it so I can actually feel the buttons turning and clicking. She said, No, you can still touch the screen. The actual menus on the screen are not going to get hot. And I went, no, I've got my guide dog here. I've got my white stick. That normally means that I can't see what's on the touchscreen. So I need it made accessible. And then she finally got it. And, you know, one of the things that I like to say about accessing anything in particular is it's like writing a message in the sand, because every time the tide comes in, it wipes it out and you've got to redo it again. So when I go out to retail places or anywhere else, I feel like I have to keep saying the same message over and over again, that the standard way of accessing things may or may not work, and there has to be other solutions available to allow, you know, blind or low vision people or any other person that's got a disability access to it, you know, a device, hardware, software or services.
Is it difficult, though, for technology developers or designers to know where to start if they do want to make their products accessible? Because when we talk about impairment or disability, I mean, there are various levels, aren't there? And there are different types of disability, different types of impairment.
Look, it's where to start. And I remember a couple of years ago, I had a bit of an interview with someone, and they were saying, you know, how hard it is and terrible it is of developers not to make their things accessible. And the two things I like to point out is, one, it's lack of awareness. So, you know, it doesn't sometimes enter into people's minds that they might want to look at other ways of making things usable, accessible. And then number two, if I wasn't in this field already and somebody said, look, I've just produced this fantastic app, it does X, Y, and Z, where do I go and have a look at how people are using this technology or how they can access it? I probably wouldn't have anywhere to start. I guess one good thing about the digital access team at Vision Australia that I work for is that you've got a spot where you can go, and not just for blind and low vision access, but we also look at all accessibility, whether it's physical, motor, cognitive, vision, hearing, the whole lot. Because if you just make one particular system accessible, let's say for a blind person, that doesn't then follow on that it's accessible for anybody else. So we like to say that we're looking at inclusive design for absolutely everybody, not just for people that have got a recognized disability. So, you know, sometimes my wife forgets her glasses. Now, she drives a car and she's a sighted person, but if she forgets her glasses sometimes, she just boots up the large print on the computer screen and then she can see it. And to me, that's accessibility.
Now, there have been advances, significant advances, with voice recognition software in the last few years. For somebody like yourself with vision impairment, just tell us about those advances and how effective they've been.
I have to say that it's been absolutely staggering, the amount of productivity and efficiency I've got for voice recognition systems. And, you know, the main two that we always hear about is, you know, Siri on the Apple platform and Google Now on the Android platform. And it's fantastic because I can basically, with these voice recognition systems built into smartphones or tablets, if somebody rings me up and says, look, David, I've got a meeting for you on Saturday morning, can you make it? I can just ask my voice system to say, do I have any appointments on Saturday? It'll come back and say yes or no. And then I can straight away say to the person, yep, look, I'm available at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. And then with the voice recognition system, I can then say, please put an appointment in for this date and time. So it makes it much more efficient and faster. People sometimes ring me up and say, here's my reference number or serial number for my software. I can use the voice recognition system to quickly put that into a system. The fantastic one that I love using now with voice recognition is particularly when it's windy, because I use my hearing to navigate a lot of the times. There's been a few times that I've got a bit disorientated, so I can quickly say, where am I? And get my current address and location to find out where I am exactly. That's really, really helpful. And then when I travel overseas, because of time zones are always different overseas, it's really embarrassing as a blind person to get up in the middle of the night and start walking around somebody's house when it's completely pitch dark outside. So one of the nice little things I use my voice recognition system for is to say, is it dark outside or what time is sunrise? So then it'll come back, and because I've got my speech running on my smartphone, it'll tell me.
And look, just finally, as you say there, there are significant benefits from voice recognition software as it's developed. Are there still some challenges though?
There are, because one of the major things about voice input, and this is really coming out now with the smart TVs coming out in the market, they say, you know, not only can you use the remote, but you can also speak to your television. Well, that's absolutely fantastic. The problem is, if you can't see what's on the screen, whether you're blind or low vision or may have another disability or maybe you forgot your glasses, then you need some sort of feedback coming back from the television set to let you know what's happening on the screen. So for me, that's a really huge important thing that, you know, it's great to have voice input, but we need voice output. And the other thing that is also coming up more and more now is audio description. So the ability to be able to actually have a spoken track on top of a movie or a TV show. And I know the ABC is currently running a trial called ABC iView Trial. So that's the iView app on the smartphones and tablets. And that started in April last year. It's running for 15 months. So we're hoping that's going to be extended by the government. But all of the major players now are actually doing audio description. So, you know, there is a way to go. I mean, I'd love audio description as a blind person. I'd like more alternative to touchscreen technology. I want voice output rather than voice input. So there is a way to go. But this sounded very strange. I said to somebody the other day, it's a really good time to be blind in some ways, because there are so many different things available. And you can give developers and researchers and manufacturers so many options on where they can make their hardware or software products more accessible.
Well, David Woodbridge, it's good to finish on a positive note. Thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
That's okay. My pleasure. And thank you for having me.
And David is the Senior Adaptive Technology Consultant for Vision Australia. We also heard today from Tom Griffiths, a Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and Filippo Jakob, the co-founder and CEO of Primo Toys. Karin Savanovitz is my co-producer here at Future Tense. The sound engineer this week was Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.